at X Squared Radio, you can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping. They have come a long way, you know. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. There is no better way to view the sun than with a coronoscope. Trust me, you will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You just might save the planet. Plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio.
Explorers to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. My guest tonight is Victor Vigiani. We want to let you know that you can call in. The phone lines are all open. Toll free USA, 877-876-5227. Anywhere in Canada, toll free. We haven't forgotten about you, 888-815-9756. And anywhere else, on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can get to us, 530-876-3222. It won't take you long to call in and ask a question. We'd like to hear from you. This year makes 60 years since the Roswell crash. It has been the most debated event in history, certainly in science history. But by many accounts, did it actually happen? Where are the pieces? What did we really learn? And more importantly, can we handle the truth? Well, my guest is Victor Vigiani. Perhaps he can help us find out. Victor, we are in the present right now, but this is the hour where we kind of stretch out into the future and ask, what is going to happen in the UFO genre in the next few years? We like to speculate here. We like to open up every avenue, especially when we get a guest that's got as many years of experience as you. You've talked to so many people. You've seen so much evidence. You've heard so many testimonies. I know you're one of the pillars in the exopolitics leadership on the Earth today, and this hour, we're going to go into the future of ET involvement on Earth. We have so many dreams about being human and the fact that we sense so much more in the universe than our eyes and ears can discover. We imagine things. We have visions. We have, you know, encounters of various kinds. Some people have even had ET encounters. You know, I scarcely know a person who does not have these thoughts, and I'm not really sure why they're happening or where they're coming from. Maybe it is some kind of grid that's around the Earth. Maybe it's some kind of consciousness that's being poured out on the Earth. It's difficult to say. But according to scientists studying the galactic record, Earth is not from around here, and perhaps we aren't either. What are your thoughts on the idea that we human beings are originally from somewhere else?
Oh boy, what are my thoughts? You mean the physical form that we take today?
Yeah, the physical genetics that makes up the human being. It's obvious that the DNA is not an evolved molecule. It's an engineered molecule, and it didn't crawl forth out of the primordial ooze. Somebody put it together. What are your thoughts?
Well, I haven't really formulated too many solid, in my own mind, believable it, to the point where I can really say to myself, yes, this is the way it is. But I have a real difficulty with the fact that given who we are as these corporeal beings that we exist in at this point in time, and the duality of our existence, this whole spiritual aspect, and I use that word spiritual only because there's no other word that I can think of in my lexicon that describes it. When we exist in this duality of the physical and the non-physical, I come to the conclusion that at some point in our existence as beings, or in the way we originated as beings, that there was some sort of intervention in the way we came to be on this planet, whether we did evolve from the primordial goo that sometimes we think of in terms of crawling out of the water and eventually walking upright, or that the human species came from someplace else. The only conclusion that I can really come to, Brooks, about this is that at some point in time, something that's greater than we are or that's different than we are injected some sort of the spiritual to us. Now, what does that mean? Well, whether we developed from another species or we were some sort of grand experiment from some other place in some other time, that entertains the question of us coming from, in fact, someplace else, or that the evolution that we saw on the planet, which I don't really believe wholeheartedly, at some point, the spiritual nature was injected into us. And I really have not come to any firm conclusion. But most of the reading that I have done, I'm sort of the conclusion that we did and that we have come from, in fact, someplace else, and that we may be part of the meeting that we are eventually going to have with the people who brought us here. And I'm talking about the extraterrestrial civilizations. My opinion is, and the reading that I've done on it, is that we are of them. We are like them. We are very similar to what they are in the nature that they possess. And that's why I think they value us so highly. And the way that we have evolved has shown them that that we are worth saving, despite many of our foibles, despite some of the behaviors that we have engaged in. We are a bunch of children who have learned to play improperly in the sandbox. And for whatever reason, we need to be redirected in the kinds of behaviors that we exhibit. And we have to learn to play nicely in the sandbox, or we are going to be on a path of oblivion. And we are setting ourselves up for that right now. And when you talked about, at the beginning of the hour here, looking into the future, I think that's what humanity has to look forward to. We have the opportunity to engage whoever these beings are and to learn from them, A, where we came from, if there is reality in that speculation, and then B, what are we going to do with the future that's in our hands? And is there a future for us as a species? I firmly believe that there is. And that's the whole journey that I think we're on as a human species. And engaging the off-world metaphor, whatever that might mean, and I have no preconceived notions necessarily as to what it might mean. I think there's a set of possibilities that are there, but it could be something very different than we're expecting. And when we engage in that journey, I think we are going to discover something about ourselves and the nature of the universe that is very different than what we suspect. So that's my thoughts on that.
Well, I think I'm with you on that almost every step of the way. Most of the people that I talk to who have had, well, let's call it more advanced interactions with thoughts or imaginations or even contact with ETs have a way of accepting that the future is going to look way different than it does right now. The other people that I talk to who maybe have space in their imagination for the possibility that ETs exist, but maybe not so much space in their imagination for the fact that they have existed before this world, or that they will exist after this world in some form other than being on a cloud in heaven playing a harp. They have a more difficult time imagining something beyond the mere 100-year lifespan of a mortal human being. And I'm not really sure what it's going to take to open that up, but the visitation of off-worlders has been mentioned seriously by every race of every possible level of development. We find records in caves, in medieval paintings, on the side of pyramids. It's sort of a permanent record that they have always been involved, or at least amused with us. So why are we, as a supposed modern people, so stubborn to accept the idea and move forward with a global cooperative space program that reflects that? Why are we going forward in such a secretive, militaristic manner with respect
to
space?
To be really honest with you, Brooks, I believe there's a very, let me just entertain this possibility.
Sure. I believe
there's a very easy answer to that question. And I think the answer to it in the North American realm is the nature of democracy. If you look at, and I'll try to explain this, the nature of democracy allows for open debate. It's at least in its initial, inception, it really proffered the idea that everyone has the capacity to determine their own future or to make decisions about their future and articulate that. And once that concept or that notion became ingrained in the North American society, particularly where you and I live on the North American continent, and the idea of a democratic, free society where we elect a government, that's when I believe myself personally that the whole idea of the arrogance of constitutional, validity of a government and to be allowed to assert itself on the planet as an entity that says, we know the way to the truth. And when you say that as a government, and when you put in place a government who can espouse those notions, and as soon as that government begins to collect financial resources in order to protect those constitutional rights, namely the democratic freedom that we all think that we enjoy today, then you begin to put in place a series of protectionist ideological belief systems that develop an economic system that hoards information, that hoards money, and that seeks to control aspects of the planet's affairs, meaning the acquisition of land. And when you begin to, as a government, acquire land and acquire finances and economic development, and when you begin to collect from your people money to allow that government or that institution to disseminate, you begin to put into place a process where you denigrate other aspects of reality, meaning other ways of life. And you can see what's going on in the rest of the planet. The acquisition of land by certain governments in the 30s and the 40s, namely the Nazi Germany, we had to somehow find a way to counteract that. So what you had to do is you had to build, and this is the story of humanity all the way along, this is nothing new. Humanity has always been involved in protecting its own land, protecting its rights, and saying that we have the right way to a belief structure. And this belief structure has become so ingrained that we as a society here in North America think this is the only way that you have to think about the way the planet should be used. And when you have a race of people saying that this is the way the planet shall be used, we shall use fossil fuels and we shall cut down trees, and we shall segment our society in certain ways so that we have access to goods by certain numbers of people on the planet, and access and deny access to goods and services to other people on the planet. You set up a situation where automatically you're alienating people from the truth. And so how did we get into this position? Because our governments have been given the freedom to do this, and then we have alienated ourselves from the freedom of choice that we really have to put in place, is understanding that we are existing on a planet where there's a community of efforts, a community that has to be built in to assist one another. So you have a situation where there are the rich and the poor. And when you have that paradigm, you have a series of wants and needs, and those are to be denied to certain people and given to freely by others. And that's a situation that we've come to respect as democracy. And unfortunately, I think, in answer to your question, the ideology of democracy has put us in a very, very tenuous situation. Democracy is not necessarily being played out as it originally was intended. And you can see how the planet has become economically, I guess I'll use the word raped, because of it. And so we are in a very difficult position. And I'm not quite sure that the idea of democracy and a free society, the way we think it's being played up right now, is the way that that things have to unfold. So I know that's a difficult. You know what I'm saying? It's just it's put us in a position where we're tromping on people's rights in order to uphold our own.
Yeah, I find myself trying to wonder about an alternative, but I do see some weaknesses in the system, which, at least in the business I'm in manufacturing, weaknesses in processes are always fleshed out when they're implemented, but at least we have the power to go in and then adjust the process to get the results that we want.
Uh-huh.
In democracy, which we don't really have, we have a representative republic. We sort of elect people, send them to Washington and say, by the way, I want you to vote the way I would vote if you were in Washington.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, the way our system is set up, and it was set up about 300 years ago, the instant a person gets to Washington, at least in Congress, he immediately has to go right back into campaign mode because, gosh, the next election's only 2 years away. So if he wants to keep his job, he has to keep placating the very constituency that put him in office, which means he has to go right back into sending out mailers and raising money, and that there starts the cycle. And if you're successful at it, then you have built a dynasty of supporters that will back you no matter what. What you have to do is, of course, send the bacon home. And you send the bacon home to those people who are donating the most money to your campaign. So if you just follow the money, you're right. We have set up a system that perpetuates fear and facilitates those people that would take advantage of such a system for exactly the reasons that we've been talking about for the last 2.5 hours.
Precisely.
Does that mean democracy and freedom is bad? No. But what it means is somebody needs to go in and fix the system. I don't know if term limits are the answer, but I certainly think an idea about lengthening the term so that people are not in constant campaign mode trying to stay in the power seat in Washington needs to be implemented. There needs to be some way to keep switching those people out with the bus drivers and the school teachers and the policemen and the plumbers and the mayors so that we have fresh faces in Washington all the time, really representing the people, not representing themselves. And then we've also fleshed out the idea that it may not be the elected officials that stand in front of the cameras at all that are running things. There's only about 25% of the budget that they have any control over.
That's correct, yes.
By bureaucrats that we never see. And,
well,
and they're behind the walls of the Pentagon, and I don't know what your defense building is called in Canada, but that's where the real money is, isn't it?
Of course, of course.
That's and where the real decisions are made, what kind of science projects are going to be launched and what kind are not going to be launched. So when it comes to global cooperation in space, that's where the decisions are made, in the bowels of NASA, not in Congress.
Mm-hmm. Well, you make several points there about the nature of politics, and be it a church institution, be it a city, a municipality, a large government, international governments, when your whole system of interaction depends on the polemical nature of arguments, the politics, that's where the word politics, you know, you're blending all the time, you're blending polemics all the time. And these polemics of economics, of militarism, of energy usage, you know, resource usage, when the politics become involved in all of that, the flow of money lubricates that whole system. And when you have a system that's well lubricated by power, money, and influence, you have a system where people like yourself and myself, we engage in the charade of electing officials every number of years, you know, and here in Canada it could be every 4 or 5 years, whatever it happens to be, and you engage in this charade called an election, and you think that it's an engagement of a political system, where in fact the engagement really is just a perpetuation of that system that's lubricated by money, power, and influence. And that has been repeating itself over and over again, and then as a result of that, you have these huge numbers of families, and I use the word not in a familial sense, but these large organizations that are magnets for the power, the influence, and the control. And you cannot get out of those types of structures. It's extremely difficult for democracies to represent themselves when there are larger forces, economic forces especially, that are out there that are controlling the politics of the situation. And then you talk about the flow of information, you know, in the media. When those families, when those organizations actually control the flow of information, the quality of information, where all you're involved in and all you want to know about who the next supermodel is going to be, or who's going to survive on Survivor, or what guest Oprah Winfrey is going to have on her television show tomorrow, you know, when you're involved in those kinds of speculative engagements all the time, you begin to get into a mode of desensitization. You begin to not care about the nature of the information that you're dealing with. And information changes people. And information has changed the North American consumer into a being that does not care about their existence in terms of where we're going spiritually. All they're concerned about is who is on Oprah tomorrow morning and who the next survivor is going to be and all of these other mundane questions that are a result of how media tells us what's real. We do not know. We no longer know what is real. And the amount of confusion about what is real, Brooks, is so toxic to our spiritual being, we no longer consider ourselves as being spiritual beings. We are totally corporeal beings that require economic satisfaction, instant gratification, and a big new car every 2 or 3 years. And when you have a race of people who dominate the economic system the way North Americans do, that becomes the reality. And unfortunately, the way to the truth about who extraterrestrials are has no way of seeping into that reality. So it's very difficult for people.
Exactly. I mean, you bring up a really good point. Here they have a system, and it works. You know, let's keep getting reelected. Let's keep the checkbook in our hands, and as long as it is, you know, we'll maintain our power and influence in the world. And then comes along a wild card, something outside the box, something that's not affected by that economy, an ET, an extraterrestrial race with superior technology that can fly with impunity through skies that have been claimed as that air superiority has been claimed by the local government, and yet this race can fly through with impunity. Now you have something that is not in control. Now you have something that threatens the structure of how they have all the resources of an entire planet funneled through their bank. It usurps all that. It changes everything. And now I think I understand why they would weaponize space.
Of course. You hit the nail right in the head, Brooks. You hit the nail right in the head. When people ask, well, why are they doing this? There's a lot of reasons why, but the number one reason why is that if this information were to come forward, the powers that be and the number of organizations that have assumed this control would automatically default in this control, and they do not want that to happen. So therefore, you limit the discourse about this whole set of information, and you leave it to people like you and I to talk about on radio programs that may or may not be listened to by any numbers of millions of people. And even when it does come to the forefront to discuss this thing in open, rational debate, as we're trying to do up here in Canada, and I think maybe perhaps we could spend a few more minutes talking about what we're doing up here in Canada to begin this discourse, what really happens is really, really interesting. A whole different realm of debate opens up, a whole different idea, and people react in the strangest way when you begin to talk about asking your elected officials at the highest possible level that we're doing up here in Canada to talk about the debate and to open up the debate and to even admit that debate exists. We maybe have to spend a moment to describe what we're doing.
Yeah, what happens when you do that? I know what happened when Paul Hellyer came out and made his statement, but
well,
you know, he was heading out. What about the people that are in office now?
Well, let's talk about that for a moment. Paul Hellyer, the story as to how that happened was my friend and colleague Michael Bird and I were planning a symposium up here in Canada at the University of Toronto at Convocation Hall, which is, you know, Convocation Hall in the University of Toronto is it's the largest university in Toronto. And we were planning this open forum with Richard Dolan and Stanton Friedman and our good friend Stephen Bassett. We asked them to come forward to give presentations at this conference at the University of Toronto in September of 2005. And at the time, I was doing a radio program here in Toronto. And after one of the radio programs was over one night, I got a call from a listener and said, "You really should talk to a friend of mine. I think he'd be interested in hearing more about what you're saying." And this person pointed me towards Paul Hellyer. And at the time, I did not think anything of it. And I spent, you know, several weeks, ruminating over whether or not to contact Mr. Hellyer. And at a certain point in time, I did. I decided, well, maybe I'll just give this fellow a call and see what he's all about. Well, as soon as I called him, that's when the debate started. I called him in early May of 2005, as we were in the planning stages of this conference. And he came forward with some information and an idea that he wanted to pursue, because we had given him some information that really, began the burning flame that became the exopolitical movement up here in Canada. He read a book called The Day After Roswell by Philip Corso, and he was about three-quarters of the way through this book after I had spoken to him that summer, and he said he needed to stop reading the book because it was just too overwhelming for him, and he stopped reading it for about a week or so. And he spoke with his nephew about this particular book, The Day After Roswell. And he said, "I just don't know whether or not to believe all of this stuff." So his nephew said, "Why don't you call so-and-so in the United States Air Force?" And this man was a retired four-star general in the United States Air Force. And he lives someplace in the Midwest. And we still to this day do not know who this general is, this four-star general. In any case, Mr. Hellyer called the four-star general and asked this general, "I'm reading this book, The Day After Roswell by Philip Corso. Is it true? What's going on? I'm totally confused by all this information." The four-star general said, "Paul, Mr. Hellyer, everything in the book is true and more." And at that point, the general and Mr. Hellyer carried on a conversation about the truth and the and more. And that convinced Mr. Hellyer that he had to come forward. And then he did that at the conference here in Toronto, at the University of Toronto. And at that conference, it's extremely powerful. That information went literally around the planet. And after that conference, it was just like a fire that was ignited. And I'm sure you know, as you mentioned, you heard about this happening. And since that time, since 2005, we in Exopolitics Toronto have taken this message and tried to bring it to our elected representatives. And just recently, with the support of the Canadian Exopolitical Initiative, we have sent a letter to the Governor General of Canada. Now, the Governor General in Canada is the representative. She is the head of state, the dignitary who represents the Queen. She's a non-elected official, but she is the official head of state, and more ceremonial than anything. So we have our prime minister, similar to what you have as the president, but the governor general here in Canada is the sort of the dignitary head of state that represents the Queen. Well, she doesn't have any official power per se, but she is in fact the ceremonial head of our government. And she is a very powerful and very, very influential person, and the office itself of the Governor General is extremely powerful. We sent a letter from ExoPolitics Toronto, from ExoPolitics with Alfred Weber in the Institute for Cooperation in Space, and on behalf of the Disclosure Project to the Governor General, asking her to engage in briefings with us. And she sent a very polite letter back to us, and we've just made the news last week that the Governor General has responded to us and asked us to go forward and seek more information from CSIS, the Canadian Security System here in Canada, the equivalent of the CIA and the Canadian Space Agency here in Canada. So we are now in the process of engaging those two organizations and asking them to come forward to assist us with briefings about the whole extraterrestrial question here in Canada, what they know about it, and with us to share our information with them. So as you can see, we here in Canada are really making great strides to inform our political officials about what's going on and share information with them and not engage in a confrontational, please give us the information or, you know, we're going to, you know, kick up a fuss. We don't want to do that. We want to engage in a cooperative way. So we're really happy about that and very, very enthusiastic about the inroads that we've made up here in Canada.
That's exciting stuff. Now, is this going to air or is it going to be made public somehow? Is it going to be on the radio? Is it going to be in print, the results of this?
Well, right now, the print of this, the letter to the Governor General is available on our website, and the actual response of the Governor General will be available on our website. The information that we have got connection with the Governor General is already in print up here in Canada. It has been printed in several of our newspapers, and is also on the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. It's our public broadcasting system up here in Canada, and it has been covered here in Canada on the CBC website. So eventually, we're hoping that this information can become a little bit more deep-seated, and eventually, with the help of other individuals here in Canada, primarily the representatives of the leadership of the Liberal Party, Mr. Michael Ignatieff, who's the deputy leader of the Liberal Party, and Stéphane Dion, the official leader of the opposition here in Canada. We are going to also involve them in this information and ask them to get involved with the briefings with us. So this whole idea is moving forward to allow us to sit down with these individuals, and how the press wants to cover this is yet to be seen. But when we do get the cooperation of these individuals, we are going to be definitely making news about it for sure, and we're very confident that the Canadian press will cover it, as will hopefully the world press. So we're very enthusiastic about it.
Well, now they know about it on X Squared Radio, and although we don't have many live listeners, we have a lot of people that listen to the archives and people that go to the PBS Radio Network and access our page there. It's in excess of 12 million people a week, so that's a lot of people that...
My goodness, that's terrific.
They hear about this stuff, and it really has a great effect. And, of course, we're going to be at various conventions this summer at the UFO convention in San Francisco, at the Earth Transformation Conference in Trout Lake, Washington, from the 6th to the 8th of July, and then the 9th through 12th of July at Mount Shasta, and then there's just a lot of stuff going on this year. And next year we plan on 17 appearances, and of course next summer, we're not going to give out the month because we're trying to actually make it happen. So if we put out a month, it gets a little bit of opposition from here and there. We do the expedition, which is a voyage to the Arctic regions to actually search for some magnetic or geological anomaly that's consistent with hollow earth theory. Nobody's ever been there, so this is going to be a really neat documentary that we do. Now that's going to definitely start a momentum ball rolling. So we're doing some really cool stuff, and we're trying to keep the awareness up and the positive nature of the genre up. And maybe we'll be invited to speak at some of the UFO conventions. I know I've been around to a few MUFON conventions, but mostly they have their own community of speakers, so we're not involved in that yet. We've had a lot of them here on this program, and you're certainly one of the heavy hitters that have been on this program, and we greatly appreciate you coming on. What, other than this effort that you're doing up there with those dignitaries and this effort in Canada, what else have you got planned for 2007?
Well, myself and Michael Byrd, the director of Exopolitics Toronto, we are, one of the things that we're going to try to do is we are attempting to look at another exopolitical conference here in Toronto during the year 2008. And what we're attempting to do is, and one of the big problems with all of this, Brooks, is that we have always found, and one of the different ways, just different unique approaches that we're taking here in Canada, is the conference model that we have been to, and we've been to several conferences in the United States and in Canada. We find that we are speaking to the converted. And
oh, yeah, exactly.
That has always posed a philosophical problem for us. With the first conference that we had in 2005, we had a really great turnout, about 500 people in the convocation hall. But by and large, other than people that were in the press, we got some really good coverage in the press from that, with Mr. Hellyer's presence and the three speakers that we had. However, for the most part, we were speaking to the converted. And I've been to many conventions where people will put their slides up on the screen and look at the, crash site investigations and sighting reports and data reports and so on and so forth. Michael Byrd, our director, and I firmly believe that that is not the way to go. We are looking at a different process, a different paradigm in presenting information to people. And what we'd like to do in the next conference that we have is speak to people, and how we're going to do this is up for debate, and we've got a few ideas, but we want to engage people on an everyday level. We want to meet people on the street. We want to find out what people are thinking on the street and what they want to know about this, and thinking of ways, developing organizational models that will allow us to bring in people, both press and general public, that know very, very little about this. And how do we do that? And that's the big challenge for us here, up here in Toronto with the exopolitical movement. We want to pass this message along to the unconverted, not necessarily to people who are skeptical or don't want to believe or whatever. That's another question altogether. What we want to do is talk to people who are open-minded and who want to know more about this, but yet have no firm conviction or belief system or even knowledge base about it. And the question is, how do you get to these people?
Which community would you seek audience first? Would you go to churches? Would you go to sports teams? Would you go to astronomers? I mean, most of the most close-minded people that I know are my astronomer friends. They just won't hear about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, in what community do you go to? Do you go to universities
The idea of using the university model is one that we are very seriously considering. And that's one of the reasons why we use University of Toronto during our 2005. However, most of the people, by and large, who came to that conference were people who found out about it over the web or the advertising that we had done. And it really wasn't the student model that we wanted to get to. But all things being equal, we would like to get into the universities here in Canada and attempt to meet with some of the university chancellors, presidents, and so on and so forth, to allow us to use the university setting to move into some of the coursework that's going on, definitely in political science and anthropology and sociology, and even into the areas of physics. But that's a very difficult one to move into because the scientists are pretty close-minded about this. So we are going to open up our discussion in the areas of anthropology, sociology, and political science, and hope that we can make some serious inroads in talking to some of the directors of the departments there and begin to set up a model of discussion about the exopolitical movement, and stay away from showing necessarily, you know, pictures of UFOs or data reports and so on and so forth, but looking at some of the government contacts and agencies that we have been in contact with that have information about all the
wireless phones about to give out. I'm not sure.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's one of the ideas that we have, and we firmly believe, Brooks, that the dissemination of the exopolitical agenda is contingent upon using a different model, a different approach that's been used traditionally over the last 30 or 40 years in the world of ufology and in the ufological community. And make no mistake about it, the actual infighting that we see going on over the last number of years is absolutely phenomenal within the ufological community. The UFO community is fraught with dissension, derision, ridicule among themselves. And we've decided, made a conscious decision to stay away from that type of debate. And when they get their act together, then, you know, when I'm setting up it's not a pretty sight, really, but the fact of the matter is that whatever type of discourse, excuse me, is brought about within the UFO community, it always lands up of he said, she said, and denying and ridiculing points of view. We don't have time to do that. The time is too short.
Right, no time for that.
Yeah, we've got to get into more of a collaborative model. And I suppose the academic model of inquiry is much more, I guess, the potential of that level of inquiry has much more to do with seeking out the truth than questioning judgment of people who say certain things. And where all ideas are open to scrutiny, and where the press gets to see that the way this type of information is going to manifest itself is going to be in an academic setting where people can engage in the generation of ideas and the examination of ideas instead of the ridicule of ideas. So, you know, ufology is, you know, dealt with ridicule for too long, and we want to move completely away from that. So those are some of the things that we're thinking about doing. And the other thing that we're attempting to do very strongly is develop close bonds with some very well-trusted and very interested media sources here in Toronto and throughout the province of Ontario. I've developed an extremely strong cohort of journalists who are seriously interested. I'm talking about mainstream journalists who are very serious about acquiring more information about this. So the seeding of that notion and the seeding of that whole initiative is very important to us. We've developed some very good contacts that have been assisting us over the past 3.5 to 4 years. So
what
as you can see...
Is it television or newspaper or radio? What media is it?
All of them. We have some tremendous contacts in radio. The radio program that I do on CFRB News Talk Radio 1010 here in Toronto is the largest AM radio station in Canada, and as some of your listeners may know in the area of Kentucky or even the ones that listen to us on the internet, Toronto is a city of well over 4 million people. And not only is Toronto a large metropolitan city here in Canada, the GT area, the GTA, the Greater Toronto area, is well in excess of 7 to 8 million people. So we reach a lot of people in Ontario, in the Toronto area, as well as northern part of New York State. That's the CFRB umbrella that we reach. It's a very powerful radio station. So we do that. And we also have tremendous media cooperation from several radio, television stations that I myself have been on. And these are major, the CTV network, I've been on there 3 times, on their news programs, Breakfast TV, CTV, television here in Toronto, I've been on there 3 times, and newspapers, I've written several articles for the Canada Post in the month of March. One of my articles, a letter to the editor, was the main letter of the week, and it talked about our letter to the Governor General in addition to some other things that we're doing in exopolitics. So we're beginning to really make some serious inroads with the media, all shapes and forms of it, TV, radio, and in the newspaper. So we're making some great headway, and we need to cultivate these relationships and bring these people on board, because there is definitely an open ear up here in Canada among the media types. So we're very enthusiastic about that, too.
Awesome. That is amazing work.
Yeah.
and you have a good team working with you, and you guys already do a lot of very good publication. If you go to the website at exopoliticstoronto.com, there's enough to read there for a whole afternoon if you want to spend your evening reading that. These guys write world-class articles. They have the great guests on it. They make major press with these articles, and they're doing a very, very good work as far as getting the idea out there that there's really nothing to be afraid of, and let's go ahead and posture ourselves as a people to get ready for real meaningful, you know, contact, not for entertainment purposes only, with extraterrestrials. And I am envious of your 30-year career in this, and I'm doing what I can for the last, I guess, 27 months I've been on the air. I wasn't always in radio. I was just a commercial engineer and scientist that happened to write a book that got some airplay and ended up doing some radio interviews, and somebody said, hey, why don't you have your own radio program? So I did.
And that's the way it works. Yeah.
It's a great hobby, and I enjoy it, and I get to meet wonderful people like you, and I can't wait to actually physically come face-to-face with you and shake your hand someday. I know we'll be at an event somewhere together, because this is a small genre, and the people that make a name in this, at least in the sense where the common person likes to hear what they have to say, they're all going to end up in one place at one time, sooner or later.
I think so. I really believe that strongly, that all of us that are working towards this, and there is a huge and growing community throughout the world. I've come into contact with so many different people in Brazil, in Italy. I spent time with Paula Harris last March in Rome with Paula, and other people in the United Kingdom, in the Netherlands, in Mexico. It's just even, and in Australia, I spent an entire year in Australia with my wife in the year 2003, and the amount of information and the initiatives there are just amazing. So the community is building, and it's building, and it's coalescing, and it's becoming more and more like-minded and compelled by the fact that we have to get this information out, and that we have to create this meaningful dialogue, this meaningful discourse about it, and show our politicians that this is not something, as you mentioned earlier, Brooks, that we have to be afraid of, or that we should, for one reason or another, not discuss. There's absolutely no reason on this planet not to discuss this. There's no reason in the world why this cannot be the substance of debate on the floors of our government, be they in Congress, or be they in Parliament, or be they in the, you know, in any government building in or institution on the planet. There's no reason in the world why this cannot be open to public debate and public discourse. There's nothing to be afraid of. Information is something that we need to cherish, and we need to exchange, and we need to examine. And the information about the extraterrestrial presence is so compelling, so huge, that to deny its existence is to deny the truth of yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And we cannot do that. We cannot deny our past. We cannot deny our present. And we cannot deny our future. So in order to hold those three aspects of our existence up and hold it up in an authentic, true manner, we have to talk about it. It's like a family, you know, keeping a secret. We all know that, you know, families have their secrets, things they don't want to talk about. But the way families grow and the way they achieve true authenticity is by talking about information, talking about the difficult things in life, talking about the difficult things that make them a family. And once that information is put on the table for all of us to discuss, it becomes an authentic experience. And we engage the information, and then we become changed by it. The information changes us. We cannot change the information. We cannot change the information to suit our own comfortability. We have to allow that information to alter our perceptions, to alter the way we think about ourselves. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, that this program exists and the great work that you're doing. You are presenting this information so that it will change people, so that it will make them sit up and think about the kinds of things that they dare not think about on a day-to-day basis, because it just might be a little bit too scary for them. But there's nothing to be afraid of, absolutely nothing at all. So So I'm glad that you're doing the kind of things you're doing, and being part of this community is so very, very important. And congratulations to you for doing it.
Well, I appreciate it, and I got to let you know I have people on right now from all the way from Texas, all the way to Montreal, and they've been AOL instant messaging me all the way through the whole program, and many of the questions that I ask you come from them. So I have to thank them as well. They listen, and sometimes they hear both sides of the conversation from a distance while they're milling around their kitchen or sitting there at their computer, and they think of a great question, and they go, oh my gosh, I got to get them to ask this. So they fire it off, and I try to respond as quickly as I can asking that question. Well, I have had a marvelous time, and I can't believe we've blown through 3 hours like that. I want to stay in touch with you. Do you have any books or publications coming out in the near future that we can help you publicize?
Well, no books. I've always had this burning urge to put something forward, but I know that if I do begin to write any kind of book, it'll distract me from my work in the media, and I find that the media is something that I have to stay in constant contact with. So the kinds of writing that I do, I will definitely forward to you any of the writing, any of the articles that I put forward, be they press releases or communications to other organizations. I hope that I've got your email address, and I'll put you on that list so that you could put it on your website, and that kind of information can go forward. Because I try to do it in bits and pieces rather than in one large book. Because
understand.
It's very difficult to do as an educator and as a teacher. Doing things in small packages it works for me, and I know that the kinds of the ways that the media listens to you is in small packages. You have to be very concise with what you do and very precise with the kind of information that you present to them. And in doing so, their antenna go up quite quickly. So that's where I focus most of my attention. You'll find this out also when you speak to Stephen Bassett. I know you've had him on already, but if you're going to have him on in a couple of weeks, is it next weekend or the weekend after?
It's July 1st. We actually spent 3 days together in Hawaii. He spoke at the Earth Transformation Conference. Michael Sala and Angelica White mm-hmm. put on there. So I got to know him, quite a bit better, had a meal with him and got to sit down and talk with him. And so we're going to have him on the program again. Usually when I do before those conferences, I'll have like 4 or 5 of the guests that are going to speak there come on the program, give a short synopsis of what they're going to speak about to kind of help drum up support and get some more people to go out and go to it. Stephen was just one of those resources of endless amounts of tremendously passionate material, and it's all right at his fingertips. He's got an amazing mind and an amazing way of presenting himself.
Yeah.
So we decided to have him on again. And let's see, in about 10 days, I'm going to be with Alfred Lambermont Weber at Trout Lake, Washington, at James Gilliland's Science, Spirit, and Earth Transformation Conference. If you want to go to a conference and you're in the Northwest and you want to see a UFO, that's the place to be. If you want to be there those 3 days, you may very well have your event. And I'll say hello to Alfred when I see him, and tell them that we were on the radio for 3 hours together, because that'll be good.
Oh, for
all
sure.
All right. Yeah.
Alfred and I have had many great conversations together, as Stephen and I, too. So, they're two tremendously gifted people, and we're very, very fortunate to have them working with us. And you're right about Stephen. Stephen is a person of endless energy, just absolutely compelled by pursuing the truth of all of this. So your listeners are in for a real treat on July 1st when they listen to Stephen Bassett. They'll thoroughly enjoy his presentation. And not only that, his way of thinking. He has a clarity of mind that's unparalleled in all of this. So it'll be a tremendous interview. I know that your listeners will really enjoy it.
Oh, sure. I mean, he's got a sense of humor, too.
Oh, yes.
I'll be because he has such a command of knowledge, and it's all right there, present in his mind all the time. He doesn't have to.
Right.
He doesn't have to use notes. He can stand up for 6 hours and speak extemporaneously and keep you entertained the entire time.
For sure.
Very
yeah.
Well, Victor, it's been awesome. We've come to the end of our 3-hour program, and I greatly appreciate you being on. We'll post this archive tonight. It'll be available Monday morning when people come into work, and they'll be able to access it and listen to it. So I'll make sure that you have access to it as well, and we'll just link to it, and we'll send your people here as well.
Well, it's been a real pleasure, Brooks, and I thank you very much for the opportunity, and good luck to you and all of your work, and I hope your listeners have enjoyed our time together, and perhaps we'll do it again sometime.
Very good. Thank you so much.
Okay, good night, John.
Good night. Good night. All right, space fans, Earth explorers, I have very much enjoyed having you with us tonight here on X Squared Radio. That was Victor Vigiani. His website is exopoliticstoronto.com. If you want to go to that, the link will be on the website. I appreciate my producer there in Paradise, California, doing such a great job putting the show together for us and doing my commercials for me. Next week I should be back in full form. My interface is going to be repaired, and we'll have those commercials that are so entertaining back for you. So this is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio signing off, saying we'll see you next week. Good night.
Words can't truly describe what you see. Words can't truly describe what you hear. Yet some words can inspire you to see and hear images and sounds impossible to describe. Genuvia, language of the heart. You've never heard anything like it. Like it, you will. JANUVIA.com. Available on iTunes and Amazon.
Hi, this is Jeff from Electron Love Theory, and you're listening to BBS Radio. You can hear Electron Love Theory's new album, Colors of the Galaxy, right here. Check it out further on our website, which is lovetheory.com, or on iTunes or CD Baby. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com, the number one internet radio network on the planet, in the galaxy, and in the universe.
This is Wesley Snipes. And when I'm divinely inspired and spiritually motivated, I listen to BBS Radio.com.